dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. One of the greatest battles of that war in recent memory has taken place in recent months, not necessarily understood as a battle in the sense of the kind of warfare we're actually witnessing, and yet it was. And it resulted, I believe, in the theft of the 2020 presidential race. A man who has studied this matter closely, indeed is doing a deep professional dive on it, is our first guest. His name is Jay Valentine. He is the CEO of ContingencySales.com. And, well, I like to think of him as a professional fraud detector at the industrial grade. He helped eBay defeat fraud and has been an expert witness in numerous instances, as well as an investigator of Medicaid fraud, insurance fraud of other kinds. And now he is focused on what actually happened in this election cycle. He's written about some of his insights in a piece about the industrial scale vote fraud of the election at American Thinker. We wanted to catch up with him, talk a little bit about that. Jay Valentine, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's so good to have you with us.
Very happy to be here and very happy to join you again.
Terrific. Let me ask you about the piece that you had in the American Thinker states quite categorically what you've said to me in various programs since we first met, and that is that this was indeed industrial-scale fraud that had a material effect on the election. How is it, Jay, that that runs so contrary to the narrative that we've been force-fed basically from November 3rd forward?
Well, Frank, first, let's define this as industrial-scale fraud, which is type of fraud that happens on a massive scale that has hundreds or perhaps thousands of participants, that has a loosely coupled type of organizational structure where people do similar things across multiple state lines. But the other characteristic of this is it's a sovereign crime. Sovereign meaning that this is something that is being done by the government of certain states with certain government people in the federal government who either knew about it or acquiesced to it. This is the type of fraud that definitely had an impact on the 2020 election. Had it not been for election fraud, Joe Biden would not have won. I think we can clearly state that now. And what we're seeing is you're seeing people who are part of this. And in particular, I would talk about people who were former Department of Justice officials like Glenn Kirshner, who's now saying, well, we're going to go to all of the corporate entities in the United States and we're going to make them pledge the democracy pledge that says this election was not stolen, it was legitimate. When you see that coming together, you know that everybody's circling the wagons and they're doing it because they are all on the same narrative. And that narrative goes to the people and to the media.
Let me ask you, you've described a massive conspiracy. And people who relentlessly denounce conspiracy theorists suggest that anything like this could not be kept secret, could not be kept as unknown officially as it is currently. We're going to have today, as it happens, it'll take place before this program airs, but after we're speaking, a very important program at Regent University, hosted by former Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann, who is now the Dean of the School of Government at Regent. And they're spending 6 hours doing, to my knowledge, the first serious academic drill down on what happened in this election cycle. I'm excited to see what comes of that. But Jay, How do you respond to the contention that people will blithely say, look, nothing like this could possibly have happened because there's no way to have kept it secret?
The way these types of frauds occur, Frank, is what's called a loosely coupled structure. It's something that we do in data processing all the time. People who are involved in this don't collaborate, go to a meeting where somebody says, here's what we're going to do. What they do, and they don't do this in 2020, they did this in 2016, they did it in 2018, they're doing it in 2020. Those were practice cases for 2020. So you had people, particularly in large Democratic counties, so in Atlanta, in Nevada, in Clark County, who know what they're supposed to do. What they're supposed to do is do everything they can with every tool they have to change votes. So what they did in 16 and 18 was different than what they did in 20, because in 20 they had COVID, so they had the ability to mess with all kinds of ballots. So in Clark County, Nevada, they had 92,000 ballots that were sent to people who didn't exist. Those 92,000 ballots came back and more than enough to have swung that election to Donald Trump. So don't think you need to have everybody on an email chain where they all get together. These are people who know how to change votes. They do it in not one or two ways, innumerable ways. They do it every year, and one of the real secrets of the 2020 election is it didn't happen in 2020. It happened in 2016 and 2018. Those were practice runs, and our fraud investigation is now looking at those years where much more data is available because the Democrats can't hide that data because it's been in the public sector for so long, and we're going to be able to show that the fraud that existed, not all of it, not the same types, but the same percentages that existed in 2020, there were practice runs for it in 2016, 2018, and perhaps even before that.
What is your view of the advisability of legislation now being considered by the United States Senate that would make both permanent and nationally applicable the kinds of voting arrangements that, well, you're describing as rife with fraud in the 2020 election and two before that?
Well, clearly what is happening is the Democrats are saying now we have some control and we have a person in the White House who clearly is in a state of dementia and will sign anything that we put in front of him. And so what we're going to do is institutionalize criminality. And if you institutionalize it, it's no longer criminal. This isn't the first time that we've seen this type of thing happen. It's not going to be the last. And it's what Democrats do. It's what leftists do. And unfortunately, there's not enough pushback, I don't think, because not enough people are willing to stand up and say, we are not going to allow our elections to be overtaken. So this bill may very well become law. And of course, with a Supreme Court that's weak-kneed, that's a problem.
We will be coming back to you, Jay, with much more on this. Your investigation is underway. I'm proud of you for taking it aboard and this really important public service you're rendering, as is Michelle Bachmann, will, I hope, be the sort of thing that we'll be able to draw upon to help, among other things, stave off this next stage of electoral fraud, perhaps on a vastly larger scale. Thank you for your time today. Come back to us again soon with updates, if you would. Next up, we'll speak with Carolyn Glick about an election underway today in the state of Israel and what is at work to affect its outcome. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back, and a heartfelt welcome to a dear friend and senior fellow of the Center for Security Policy. Her name is Carolyn Glick. She is an extraordinary resource on matters involving, well, the free world, but particularly her part of it, Israel, and the region in which it must operate, as well as America, from which she originally hails. We caught up with her in Israel, where we have an election taking place today in the fourth of a series of parliamentary elections. And Carolyn, by virtue of her long reporting on these subjects these days at Israel Ayom and Newsweek, and her several important books, including Shackled Warrior and the Israeli Solution, is a go-to resource on what is happening in the Holy Land at the moment and what it is likely to portend. Carolyn, so good to catch up with you. It's been a long time. Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio.
Thanks, Frank. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
So the election that never ends is going through another phase. Are you making a book on what is likely to come out of this particular version?
Well, Israel has been deadlocked right now between essentially the political forces in the country that want to restore the sovereignty in Israel to the people of Israel, to the voters of Israel, and to their elected representatives in our parliament, in the Knesset, and those who want to maintain this very bizarre situation that we have, where our legal fraternity, both the state prosecution and the Supreme Court, have absconded with the authority and the powers of the other two branches of government, the Knesset and the government, and really have brought about a very bizarre situation where the justices and the lawyers in the state prosecution essentially get to decide what their powers are. And believe it or not, since they've given themselves the power to determine their own powers, they don't think that there are any limits on their powers. So, and isn't that weird? And so the problem is, and it's hard to explain, which is why I'm really just giving the headline, is that we need to have to get a government that's coherent, that won't break up in short order or never be formed and then force us back into yet a fifth round of elections. We need to have a majority in the Knesset of people who want legal reform. And right now there are 120 members in Israel's parliament, and there are anywhere, depending on the day of the week or the pollster, there are anywhere between 59 and 62 or 63 seats in the Knesset for people who want to enact significant legal reform and to check and balance the powers of the court and of the state prosecution. And since we haven't really been able to get past 60 for the past 2 years and four elections or three elections and then today's elections, we've been deadlocked and we've been in a state of political paralysis in this country. So the big hope is that we'll get 61, 62 seats. And if we do, then we'll have a coherent governing coalition. And if we don't, then we're going to likely see a fifth election in August.
Hmm. Now, throughout this period, one constant, of course, has been that Benjamin Netanyahu has been the prime minister. Do you anticipate that he will be the prime minister after today, either way, whether there's coherence or not, or is he?
Yeah, I think he probably will be, because I don't see how a coalition of parties, according to any of the polls that have come out, are going to be able to put together a government that doesn't include Likud, the largest party by far in Israel and led by Prime Minister Netanyahu. But the powers of that prime minister are being constrained by the legal authority. So right now he's supposed to, his trial for various corruption charges that really are made up is set to start on April 5th. He's been indicted for bribery, and yet the acts that he's accused of having committed, which is trying to seek out good coverage from a media organ and receiving that coverage from a media organ, is not bribery as described in Israel's criminal code. So what they've done is they've changed the definition of bribery to try to make normal activities of a politician into criminal acts in order to indict Netanyahu with the hope of forcing him out of office. So we have this very bizarre situation where the two forces can't seem to beat one another out, because you can't get a majority either way, either for the legal fraternity to oust Netanyahu and to render politics in Israel essentially meaningless, and you can't get a majority for Prime Minister Netanyahu to end this situation where you have an unelected legal fraternity that's challenging and taking away the power of Israel's elected representatives, both in the parliament, in the Knesset, and in the government. So it's a very, very strange situation. It's hard to understand. But by the way, if you end up with a stacked Supreme Court in the United States, you're likely to have a similar situation down the road.
Yeah, this is a very important point as we're watching very active discussion of eliminating effectively the filibuster on legislation. And court packing is one of the things that is definitely in prospect. And we could well see this kind of hijacking by the third branch of government here, the judiciary, in a way that will be very, very insidious, I'm afraid. Carolyn, let me just ask you, because this sounds like a lot of inside baseball probably to most American ears. Why does it matter to the United States? You've obviously been an American patriot as well now as an Israeli one. I know you care profoundly about both countries and about their mutual security relationship. If this paralysis continues, one of the things that's very worrying to me, and I know to you as well, is what the Iranians are up to with, it seems, the strong encouragement of the new Biden-Harris administration. Talk about that as the context in which these elections are taking place, please.
Well, the Biden administration, or the Harris administration, depending on, you know, what's happening with Joe Biden at any particular moment, is...
Or even according to Joe Biden, for that matter.
The Harris administration, yeah. So, but you know, they have done what they can to try to put their thumb on the scales in favor of Israel's legal fraternity, which is very radical in its positions. And you know, again, like we were saying, there's always a problem when you talk about Israel's elections, which have so much to do with domestic politics that foreigners aren't going to be able to understand it. So, you know, just like in the United States, you saw the deep state in action working to undermine the Trump administration and block it from carrying out its policies. In an eerily similar way in Israel, we have similar forces at work that always try to undermine and block the ability of right-wing elected leaders from carrying out their policies. So, for instance, in 2011, we had an effective coup that happened in Israel, which is that Netanyahu and then Defense Minister Ehud Barak, who is now one of Netanyahu's greatest enemies, but at that time was his defense minister, wanted to order the army to carry out, to not necessarily to carry out a strike, but to prepare the military to carry out strikes against Iran's nuclear installations. And the heads of the army at the time, Benny Gantz, who is now the defense minister, Gabi Ashkenazi, who is now the foreign minister, and others who are in similarly powerful positions, and the legal advisor to the army is now the attorney general, who's been pursuing this made-up prosecution against Netanyahu, Avichai Mandelblit. They all said that Netanyahu didn't have the power to make such an order, that he had to get cabinet approval for such an order, which was untrue. So you had a commingling of forces of the so-called deep state, of the heads of the military establishment and of the legal fraternity to block the prime minister and the defense minister in this case from taking actions that they felt were necessary for the survival of the country. So we had an example already of this happening at the top levels in the most existential issue of our time. We had it to a smaller degree last year because Gantz and Ashkenazi did everything they possibly could, working with the Democrats in the United States to subvert President Trump's plan for Israeli sovereignty in parts of Judea and Samaria. So this was the Trump plan. He put it forward in January of 2020 at the White House with Prime Minister Netanyahu standing at his side. And while Gantz met with Trump and with Jared Kushner and with others in the administration and expressed his support publicly for the Trump peace plan, behind their backs and away from the cameras, he did everything that he could together with his partner Ashkenazi to scuttle the plan together with the Democrats. So, you know, this is how it played out in two very key issues.
So as not to have this be a further basis for Benjamin Netanyahu's reelection?
They're committed to an ideological radicalism that places the Palestinians ahead of Israel. Part of this has to do with a lot of, you know, it's sort of the disease of the left. If the American left thinks that the United States was born in sin and that it's an evil and sinful country and people that you know, have to change their ways by giving up their their rights to those who say that they're evil. So the left in Israel suffers from similar pathologies.
Chilling thought, and I'm afraid so true.
But we have to hope for the best. They already said that the vote is up over where it was in the last election, and you see increased participation each time. Last time, unfortunately, it was the left that was able to get their people out to vote in higher numbers, and I know that the Likud is spending most of its budget for the elections today on getting out the vote, so that, you know, the entire election campaign, they spent almost no money, and over 60% of their entire campaign budget now is going to getting people to the polls in all the countries that, in all the cities that underperformed last.
Carolyn, we'll be watching it closely, and I hope we can come back to you after it's over to get a stock taking of where it has left Israel and where it will leave us as well. Thank you for your time today, my dear. It's so good to talk with you, and God bless you for the work you do at, among other places, Newsweek, and keep it up. I know you will. And we'll talk with you again very soon. Next up, we'll speak with Victoria Coates about all of this Middle East business and more straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We're joined by Victoria Coates, a woman who I'm pleased to say is spending time these days with us at the Center for Security Policy as one of our senior fellows. I was just talking with Carolyn Glick, and I wanted to just get your thoughts on something that's afoot, apparently, in the midst of this election season in Israel. I don't know if you've been following this closely, Victoria, but it seems very worrying to me that we're watching, you know, Democratic operatives parachuting in to help the opposition to Bibi Netanyahu, and the Lincoln Project is apparently there trying to divide the Likud party that is, you know, his base of support. And obviously the administration is mucking about both with promoting Iran at the moment, Israel's mortal enemy, and kind of sabotaging some of these Abrahamic Initiative peace accord efforts and sort of recognition of them that might benefit Bibi Netanyahu. What do you make of all of that? And is it not just ill-advised, but possibly very counterproductive for our interests in the region?
Well, it's a tried and true playbook, if you accurately assess. I mean, they've been doing this going back to the Clinton administration. And, you know, it's not a coincidence that their echo chamber, led by The Atlantic, published a long form piece today about how I believe Netanyahu is one of the most crooked prime ministers in history. So that just today, picked by at random as a date to publish that. And it's another Jeffrey Goldberg piece.
Election Day.
Yeah. So, you know, this is their playbook. You'd think they'd get sick of losing, since it's happened so often, but they're coming back to the trough one more time, because I think for the Biden administration, removing Netanyahu is critical to one of their prime articles of faith. One is climate, the other is the JCPOA. And they know that Netanyahu has, you know, a great deal of support for his position on the JCPOA, both in Israel and in the United States, and that he will be a very vocal, sort of focal point of that opposition. And so if they could get him out of office now, it would really grease the skids, as it were, for them getting back into the deal.
And that's obviously of surpassing importance as far as this administration is concerned, ill-advised though it seems on many different levels, including Victoria, that it has not worked at stopping the Iranian progress towards nuclear weapons capabilities. In fact, some believe that they may already have now obtained them. What sense does it make, as you see it, to renew this agreement or simply reinsert ourselves into it?
It makes no sense. The deal was internally flawed from the get-go, with the sunset clauses and the failure to address their missiles program or their sponsorship of terrorism. And then it was fraudulently negotiated on the part of the Iranians, because one of the fundamental pillars with it was that they never had a nuclear weapons program. Their nuclear program was civilian. We know that's false because of actually Israeli intelligence, which exposed their nuclear archive and proved with primary documentation that they did have a nuclear weapons program. So the whole thing was fraudulent. The sunset clauses are already coming into effect. The notion of getting back into it is just ridiculous.
Which brings us to another area in which you have spent considerable time, both physically in country and focused on, and that is Saudi Arabia. Karen Elliott House had a piece, I believe, in the Wall Street Journal this week, in which she talked about the damage that the Biden administration is doing to the U.S. relationship with Saudi Arabia in the name of holding specifically the Crown Prince there to account for the murder of this journalist by the name of Khashoggi. She points out that this is selective concern about human rights at best, because it is simultaneously the administration giving a pass to the Iranians, who, among other things that you've already identified, is industrial scale oppressor of human rights and has been for 40 years. No.
Well, indeed. And, nobody is excusing what happened to Jamal Khashoggi, which is a horrible, I don't want to use the word tragedy, because I think of, mudslides and fires as tragedies. But it was an awful, awful event. And having been in the White House when that happened, I could tell you nobody took it lightly then. And if you look at President Trump's statement from November of 2018, I think it lays it out pretty clearly that he deplored the murder and at the same time said, he doesn't have the luxury of undermining the security of the American people over a single incident like that, and that his priority as the president of the United States has to be our national security. And Saudi Arabia has been for 70 years one of our key allies. And, you can just look at a map of the Middle East and think about, the energy reserves the kingdom has. And so, if that is one of our key strategic relationships, we are going to have to figure out a way to preserve it. And this administration has decided they don't feel that way. I believe their word is recalibrate the relationship into what looks like something far more distant. And, you can see what's going to result there, because, China is a lot less interested in human rights, as I think everyone's starting to notice, and will move right on in to Saudi Arabia if we push them away. And so you're going to wind up with, a key U.S. ally moving into the Chinese orbit, not because they want to, but because the Biden administration has pushed them there. And it's really unfortunate.
It has to do first and foremost with not doing what Donald Trump was doing and simply reversing things for the sake of reversing his policies has made matters considerably worse.
I'd also point out the reversal of the designation of the Houthi as a foreign terrorist organization, which is something we actually worked on for a number of years. It was only completed at the end of the administration, but that's a long and arduous process. And, one thing I think we all need to look at is removing an entity from the FTO list is very easy. You can do that with a stroke of a pen on the Secretary of State, which is what happened. The process to get them on the list, as I said, can take years. So I think we might want to look into some more context to the removal and some more reporting to Congress about why this is a good idea, because the Houthi have only escalated their terrorist activities, culminating in a really quite comical statement this morning rejecting the very serious and sober Saudi proposal yesterday for a ceasefire and the lifting of the siege on Hodeidah port, which was crafted in concert with the United Nations and our new envoy to Yemen, Tim Lenderking. And so very serious proposal. The Houthi and their Iranian MFA masters rejected it this morning on the grounds that somehow a ceasefire and allowing food and relief to flow in through Hodeidah would make the humanitarian crisis worse. So these are the people we're dealing with. And,
And in the meantime, they are also intensifying their attacks on the Saudi kingdom as well. I mean, all of these things, it seems, are telltales of a misbegotten policy initiative that will have far-reaching repercussions, I'm afraid. Let me ask you, Victoria, quickly before we run out of time. Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, just a quick footnote to that. The Saudis did request some additional assistance from the United States in January to defend particularly their energy infrastructure. And those requests are apparently still pending. So that's something we should all keep a very close eye on, if those requests are satisfied or if the administration decides that they're not going to help the Saudis defend themselves.
But in the meantime, they're pending and no action is being taken to try to help stave off what seems to me to be the clear knock-on effect of having done what they've done on behalf of the Houthis in the interest of romancing the Iranians. I mean, this is very, very bad policymaking, I think, and it stands in stark contrast to some of that you contributed to in the Trump years that served us rather well by contrast, for sure. Let me ask you finally about one issue that arises, going back to Israel and Iran. We may be at the point where the government of Israel, whoever is leading it, is going to find themselves obliged, as they see it, to act against the Iranian nuclear capabilities that are now either in hand or in prospect. This will almost certainly tee up a problem with the Biden administration, given the kind of orientation it has, as we've just discussed, Victoria. Should that come to pass, a man who is at a critical nexus point in the Biden administration, in the National Security Council, on which you served, as a fellow by the name of Meher Bitar, a radical Palestinian activist, and by many accounts, anti-Semitic one at that, this would not be the person you would want in such a sensitive position at a moment like that, do you think?
Well, no, certainly not to the looks of it. I've not met Mr. Bitar, so I can't, you know, comment on his personal politics or, you know, and those should be irrelevant to that kind of a position. The key to being a successful intelligence director for the NSC is a granular knowledge of the intelligence community writ large. It's not just the CIA, but, you know, it's the DIA, it's the NSA. But then you also want to have connections to the FBI, for example, to make sure you are getting as full a picture of what the IC is producing as possible, and then communicating back to the IC what the president's priorities are, because all their individual directors will be putting, you know, their priorities out. But what are the president's personal priorities? And to have someone with Mr. Bitar's history and perhaps, you know, lack of granular understanding of the IC, to me, could present a very dangerous picture, particularly, as you pointed out, in terms of Israel, with whom we have an extremely sophisticated and deep intelligence relationship. And imperiling that would be deeply dangerous from my viewpoint. And it would be hard to have confidence in someone like that from their perspective.
Yeah, the Israelis' perspective. I think you're absolutely right. Victoria, we have to leave it at that. So much more to talk with you about. I hope you'll come back to us again very soon, but thank you for your time today and for your excellent insights on so many different topics. Welcome again to the Center for Security Policy, and we'll look forward to a further chat soon.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back, and I'm always happy to say welcome to our next guest. She is Susan Katz Keating. She is an award-winning writer and investigative journalist who currently is the chief national security correspondent at a terrific outlet, John Solomon's Just the News. She has had quite a record of reporting and editing various publications in the United States, and her work has appeared in many others besides, including the New York Times, Reader's Digest, Soldier of Fortune, among others. She is a great contributor to this program. We're always delighted to have her with us. Welcome back, Susan. Good to have you today.
It's great. It's great to be here. Thank you so much for having me, Frank. Happy to be here.
So a couple of things that you've been reporting on have caught my eye and I think really warrant a little bit of a drill down. Let's talk about the state of the U.S. military Susan, and specifically, I'm thinking not so much about, you know, the quality of its, you know, equipment or even its readiness, but some of the uses to which it is being put that bespeak a kind of, well, politicization, if not an actual sort of weaponization in the political warfare, which seems to be underway at the moment, involving, among others, people like Tucker Carlson at Fox News. Walk us through that as you see it, if you would.
This is absolutely confounding, and it's a great example of what's going on in the military, because normally the military would come out and say, we will fight to protect Tucker Carlson's right to state his opinion, to use his First Amendment. However, when the military came back and slammed Tucker Carlson for making comments questioning, you know, maternity flight suit and you know, the positioning of women in the military, the Pentagon spokesman, like, that's right at the top. You know, John Kirby came out and he said he came out swinging in such a way that could only be seen as political.
Mm-hmm. Does it seem to you, based on your sources inside the Pentagon, that this is evidence of what Lloyd Austin, the new Secretary of Defense, is doing to try to show himself as a loyal, you know, lieutenant, if you will, to the Biden-Harris team? We saw, of course, you know, him throwing himself into this whole idea of having to vet and even purge members of the military who are deemed to be too loyal to Donald Trump, for example, or otherwise, you know, perhaps not on board with the Biden, you know, sort of outlook. Is that what's going on, as best you can tell?
Well, it's that, and it's also, I think, evidence of a secret that a lot of military insiders know, but it's not known too much with outside of the military, is that those higher-ranking officers, and Austin came from those ranks. Remember, he was commander of CENTCOM.
Four-star general.
The higher they are, a lot of them, they are political, and they're chosen for political reasons. And I think the reason he was chosen by Biden was because he absolutely is part of that liberal, you know, class of officers that you're seeing a lot of retired officers doing that. But yeah, absolutely, I think Austin is the lieutenant for the cause.
This is such an important point, and I don't think it's adequately understood by people outside of the military. Of course, we have the tradition of civilian control of the military. We also have the well-established practice that the military's promotions are determined with recommendations from the services themselves, of course, but ultimately determined by those same civilian authorities. And what has happened, at least going back to the Biden administration, if not arguably back to the Clinton administration, has been, it seems, a fairly serious and sustained effort to try to ensure that people who didn't fit necessarily the classic stereotype, I guess you might say, of military officers, senior personnel, particularly, you know, chiefs of staff, as being rock-ribbed, you know, conservative patriots, has been mutating over time to ensure that there are people who are with a more, shall we say, progressive agenda, given the promotions to senior ranks. And the cumulative effect of that is not only, as you say, some now retired general officers, but also Joint Chiefs of Staff that seem to be all in for the Biden program. Have I got that right?
Well, it's becoming more and more clear that this is what's going on, is that it is a politicized beast, and it should not be. And that's the beauty of our military, is that it's apolitical.
Well, it has been, that's for sure. But particularly when you combine these promotions with what seems to be a determination to purge people who may have too many emails about, oh, I don't know, President Trump or conservative themes, this is going to effectively, I believe, fundamentally transform the United States Armed Forces. And we appreciate your reporting on this because it does take careful scrutiny to discern it and to help the rest of us understand what's afoot. Susan, let me switch gears with you. You've also been reporting on the back and forth between Joe Biden and Vladimir Putin, which took on a rather direct personal quality. They have some history together, and I think it's fair to say that Joe Biden in the past got rather the worse of it at Vladimir Putin's hands. Give us a sense of what's afoot at the moment and what its implications are.
It's very serious in Russia. Now, here, I think a lot of people are kind of ignoring it or letting it go, and they're on to the next thing. But this is a very serious insult that Biden just sort of tossed off at a foreign head of state. And from Putin's perspective, this is something that absolutely must be dealt with, not necessarily for U.S.-Russia relationships, but for Putin's inner dealings with the Russian people. He cannot let this go. He can't just ignore it because it's going to completely, undercut his authority inside Russia. So he has to come across.
Now, let's explain what the nature of the snipe was from Biden, rather. He called him a killer who has no soul, I think, is what he said.
He was being interviewed, I believe it was on ABC, and was asked, do you agree that Putin is a killer? And he said, yes, I do. And then he threatened Putin that, he would suffer some kind of, he would pay a price if it were found that he meddled in America's domestic affairs. And so Putin, the ex-KGB man, very coolly said, I wish him well. And of course, as after he wished Biden well, Biden fell going up the steps. So there's a comical element to this. But Putin challenged Biden to a debate on live television because the message there is you won't be able to hold your own. And Biden didn't agree to do it. And then the most serious thing is that Putin called his ambassador home from diplomatic duty in Washington, and that's almost never done. The Russians very rarely recall an ambassador from the U.S.
The bigger issue, I guess, is really that the Russians and the Chinese have been coming into closer and closer alignment in recent years. One might even call it a strategic alliance, I think, at this point. The leaders of Russia and China, as I understand it, did a press conference in which they both expressed their unhappiness with the Biden administration and sanctions and so on. Talk, if you would, Susan, a little bit about, I think actually we don't have time to get into it at this point, but I'd like to get you back to get your thoughts on what it means that we are finding ourselves facing increasingly these two formidable adversaries partnering up on, among other things, press conferences, yes, but more to the point, strategic nuclear exercises in which they simulate attacks against this country. I mean, these are ominous developments, to say the least, and I know you're covering them, and we'll look forward to a further conversation with you about those and more in the very near future, if you would. In the meantime, we look forward to talking to the rest of you again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.